All right, well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Global Taiwan Institute. My name is Russell Hsiao. I'm the executive director here at GTI. GTI is a 501c3 think tank dedicated to Taiwan policy research. Our mission is to enhance the U.S.-Taiwan relationship by contributing to a more informed public discussion about Taiwan here in the United States and hopefully around the world. To achieve that mission, we pursue several programs. One of the programs is a bi-weekly publication called the Global Taiwan Brief, where we feature timely analysis about Taiwan and on our website, and it's available for free. If you're not already subscribed to our newsletter, you may subscribe to them at www.globaltaiwan.org. We also organize regular public seminar series, like the one that you are participating here today, where we feature experts from across the United States and also from Taiwan to discuss timely topics like the topic we are going to talk about today. We also have an annual symposium that's regularly held every September, where it's going to be our flagship event, where we bring together leading experts on U.S. policy towards Taiwan, where we can assess really the current state of U.S.-Taiwan relations, and to look forward in terms of where we can move ahead in the relationship. We also provide fellowship opportunities for U.S. scholars wanting to to conduct short-term field research in Taiwan, as well as scholars from Taiwan who are interested in conducting short-term field studies here in the United States. We're also beginning a new cultural program where we have regular movie nights here in our office, and we have featuring good movies from Taiwan, reflecting the diversity and culture of Taiwan. And we actually have one coming up this Friday. So if you you can subscribe to receive our updates on our website at www.globaltaiwan.org. Now, before I introduce today's seminar topic and speakers, I do want to take a moment and acknowledge the recent passing of an important figure in U.S.-Taiwan relations. Ellen Romberg is a very well-respected and distinguished Asia Affairs Specialist at the State Department, National Security Council, among other U.S. government posting, and he passed away on March 27th. I speak as one of countless many who benefited immensely from his sage writings in the China Leadership Monitor and discussions while he was director of the East Asia Program at the Stimson Center. When we are deeply saddened by his passing, Alan was one of the leading U.S. authorities on the special relationship with Taiwan, and I believe he would be very interested in the findings that will be presented in today's panel, political profile of Taiwan's youth, given its importance for the future of the triangular relationship. Now, I would also be remiss if I did not also acknowledge the continuous support that we receive from our co-founders and our board of directors. One of our vice chairperson, Jennifer Hu, is in the audience today, as well as our advisors and friends of the Institute. And last but not least, the wonderful staff here at GTI that makes our programs all possible. Now, given the importance of Taiwan's youth was definitely on clear display, and we saw just how important Taiwan's youth could be in 2014. But I would simply point out not only youth in Taiwan, but neighboring Hong Kong as well. Indeed, with the Sunflower Movement of 2014, a student-led protest against the lack of government transparency, Taiwanese youth became a significant factor in Taiwan's politics. There are, however, different interpretations of the political tendency of this young political generation. One popular characterization is that this generation of Taiwan's youth are born independent, pro-independent, whereas another characterization depicts this young generation as strawberry, which could be inferred that they have no strong commitment to defend Taiwan. So what does Taiwan's younger generation really think about democracy, Taiwan's relationship with China, and defending Taiwan? The Taiwan Foundation for Democracy, which is the first national democracy assistance foundation to be established in Asia, is devoted to strengthening democracy and human rights in Taiwan and abroad. And the TFD recently conducted a survey to assess these important questions about these attitudes towards these essential questions. And we will hear from the representative from TFE on these findings. I'm especially delighted to now introduce our panelists. They are truly leading experts in their field, not only for their scholarly accomplishments, but as practitioners in the art of democracy assistance. To my immediate right is Dr. Xu Siqian. He is the president of the Taiwan Foundation for Democracy. Dr. Xu represents TFD in many regional and global democracy networks or organizations, such as assuming the General Secretary of the East Asia Democracy Forum, the coordinator of the Working Group on China for the Coalition of Democratic Renewal, a member of the International Steering Committee of the Civil Society Pillar of the Community of Democracy, and participant of the Vaclavhavel Circle. To my left is Dr. Dan Twining. He's the president of the International Republican Institute, where he leads the Institute's mission to advance democracy and freedom around the world. He leads IRI's team of nearly 400 global experts to link people and governments, motivate people to engage in the political process, and guide politicians and government officials to be responsive to citizens. Previously, he served as counselor and director of the Asia Program at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Prior to GMF, Twining served as a member of the U.S. Secretary of State's policy planning staff, as a foreign policy advisor to Senator John McCain, and as a staff member of the U.S. Trade Representative. Now, to kick us off, I'll have Siqian share his presentation of the TFD's findings, and this will be followed by reactions from Dan, then kick off discussion with a few questions of my own for the panelists, and then open the floor for audience Q&A. Siqian, kick us off, please.
Okay, thank you, Russell, and thank all of you for coming here today. It's my great honor and pleasure to share with you some of the preliminary observation that we acquired from the most recent survey that we conduct. Every year, TFD conducts two surveys. One is basically on people's attitude toward democracy. And the second usually is on social equality and social justice. So because recently there I think recent many years there are debates about the particularly after Sunflower Movement, people are talking about the new political generation in Taiwan, the Taiwanese youth. And there are different way to characterize their political profile. As mentioned by Russell just now, on the one hand, there's this strong characterization of the Chinese young, Taiwanese youth as tianran du, born to be pro-independence. And we have a leader of Sunflower Movement here in the audience, Fei Fan. And he can testify to that observation, whether it's true or not. But on the other hand, here in Washington, D.C., there's also a very popular view that Taiwanese young people do not have strong commitment to defend Taiwan. So if you mix these two things together, sometimes you can have not very good picture of Taiwanese youth, that on the one hand, they're on the cross-strait relations, they can be provocative, but on the other hand, they don't have commitment to defend Taiwan. So that's the reason why I want to explore the truth of the political attitude of Taiwanese youth in this review. And also, we have seen in some of the studies, for example, in the Journal of Democracy 2016, there was this article arguing, its title was Democratic Discontent, that by Fo and Monk. I think Professor Monk is going to have a talk right now in NED, you know, on his new book. But the theme of that paper was that there was a decline of democratic support among the young people in Europe and in United States. So people are asking whether there's a similar phenomenon in Taiwan, whether Taiwanese young people, their support for democratic values is also declining. So these are the questions that I'm going to ask. So the data set was, as I said, coming from the most updated survey recently. But since 2011, we have been commissioned a series of survey, as I said, twice a year. Usually we delegate to the Election Study Center at the National Zhengzhi University. We did the same this year. Except for the most current data, we have all the data have been released to the public for academic study. And this time, because the purpose of my study was to test whether there's a difference between the political attitude of the youth and other age cohort, so methodologically, I was compelled to expand my sample of the young people. So in terms of population percentage, those people under 39 years old are only 38%, but I expanded the population into 51.7%, okay, in order to be able to compare, to do the statistic test. But of course, if I run regression, I'll weigh that back to the proportion of the population. So that's just an explanation of the data. And then let me go to the first question, whether Taiwanese young people has a declining support for democracy. So guess what? The answer is no. Quite on the contrary. Taiwanese young people has a stronger commitment and support for democratic values. Here is the result of data that we had since 2011. So the reason why I show this is to prove to you that that attitude has been stable. It's not only a one-shot picture. Okay, the red line, the dotted line is the average of people who agree that there exists some problems in democracy, but it is still the best political system, whether you agree or not. Okay, the general support is the dotted line, and the red one is the young people between 20 and 39. So as you can see, it has always been on the top, always the highest age cohort supporting, agreeing with that question, and it's going up, as you can see. Interestingly, as you can see, the lowest point is in 2014. And you know what that year is? Sunflower Movement. Okay? So at that time, people usually are, I think, frustrated, I think, about democracy. But ever since, the support for democracy is going up. So the last point is the most updated data. So as I say, this is not a one-shot picture. This is continuing trend, and but if you ask whether people are satisfied with the current situation of democracy in Taiwan, you know, Taiwanese citizens are concerned citizens. They are very critical of their political system, as in many democracies. But even with that, in general, the support is lower than the previous question, right? But still, young people is always on the top. Right, always on the top. So the previous question, the most current data, 86.2% of the young people agree that democracy is still the best political system. And the second question, whether you are satisfied, 40% of the young people are satisfied. The third question, are you optimistic about Taiwan's democratic development in the future, in 10 years. Again, young people is on the top, and the satisfaction is 41.1%. Okay, so here is the data from Fowler and Monk by their 2016 article, Democrat Discontent in Journal of Democracy. As you can see, the red line is Europe, and the blue line is U.S. But we have a little bit different question, but with the same nature of the question. Their question is, having a democratic political system is a bad or very bad way to run this country. Do you agree or not? Okay? As you can see in the United States, the younger the generation, the more agree with this statement. And our question goes, do you feel good or bad if we have an authoritarian regime in our country? And those who answer good, yeah, good, it's a good trend. The younger the generation, the less who says good, okay? So in general, the trend of Taiwan, the green line is Taiwan, right? So the younger the generation, the less the people who says authoritarian regime is good. So the trend goes the opposite direction, us in the West. So that's the answer for the first question. Young people's, Taiwanese young people's support for democracy. The answer is quite on the opposite. Taiwanese young generations has much stronger support for democracy in comparison with their older age cohorts. Okay, so that's so. Let me go to the second question. Their attitude about cross-strait relations and, so to speak, interpretation of 天然独, natural-born pro-independence. What does that mean? And whether there is such a phenomenon. As you, some of you may be aware, this is the traditional way to measure that question. The data is available both on the website of Mainland Affairs Council and the Center for Electoral Studies in National Zhengzhi University. It's always conducted by National Zhengzhi University. Okay, so that's the reason why I also delegate this to National Zhengzhi University, so that we don't have institutional effect on the measurement. What is interesting in this picture is, one thing, this is, for those people that you cannot see, I have to take my glasses down. Okay, close look at this. Okay. The black line on the top is, what is that? Maintain status quo and decide later, right? This is the top. And this blue one is maintain status quo forever. Okay? So as you can see, maintain status quo is always the majority, and still the majority. This green line, obviously, is maintain status quo and leaning toward independence later. Right? And the dark green is independence immediately. And this one is unification immediately. An interesting line is here. This, going up a little bit. You see that? This one, right? This is maintain status quo right now and go to unification later. Okay? So this is what people are paying attention a lot. That, oh, there's a change. But look at the whole picture, how big that change is. Okay? Yes, there is a change, but it fluctuates up and down. But look at the big trend, you know. The overall structure of the public opinion on this issue has not changed much. So, this is a little bit complicated, let me simplify that. Okay, into three groups. That is, pro-unification, pro-independence, and the status quo. I break that down into age cohorts. Age cohorts, right? So this is still the same data, okay, same data. As you can see, there is substantial difference, but in general, even those people under 39, which is the definition of the youth here, there are 65.5% of those people under the age of 39 that is pro status quo, okay? And 23.5% are pro independence. 10%, around 10% are for unification, okay? So, from this picture, what's the interpretation of natural-born pro-democracy? Pro-independence. My interpretation is, they are overwhelmingly pro-status quo. That's my definition. But not my definition, my interpretation. of young generation's attitude. So actually, it's not necessarily pro-de jure independence. It's actually anti-unification. Anti-unification. Okay? That's what the data says. Of course, with my interpretation. Now, let's break it even further into age cohorts below age 29. That's the green bar. Again, in the green bar, yes, there is a stronger tendency toward pro-independence here, as you can see. But there's no circle here, which means this difference is statistically not significant. Okay, when you have a circle, it means statistically significant. And here, there's no significant difference either between the age cohort of 20 to 29 and 30 to 39. But again, among those people between 20 and 29, around 65% of them are for status quo. So again, this is very obvious. A little bit higher in the pro-independence group, 26.1. Okay. Then let me suggest you another way to measure this issue. It's a very complicated issue because the way we asked the previous question is about your preference for the future of cross-strait relations. It doesn't actually tap into people's feeling or emotion, or whether it's a result of emotional preference or it's a pragmatic consideration. Actually, we cannot measure from the previous six category question. So Professor Wu Naide from the Institute of Sociology of Academia Sinica has proposed another way to measure this issue in his 2005 article, Bread and Love, A Preliminary Exploration of Taiwanese National Identity, published in the Taiwan Journal of Political Science. He proposed two questions to measure this question, two hypothetical questions. The first is, do you agree or not that if the two sides should, whether the two sides should be unified if China becomes a democratic country? Okay? Of course, it's a big if, but do you agree or not? Another question is, Taiwan should claim independence. Independence, there's a typo here, if such claim would not result in a war. Right? So you answer these two questions, either yes or no. Here, we ask that question again this wave, right? For the first question, unification question, democratic unification. Here, the blue bar is the people under the age of 39. As you can see, there's a substantial difference. Statistically significant difference. Answer to this question. This testifies to what I said. My interpretation of naturally born pro-independence is actually anti-unification. There are 73.3% of young people opposing, disagreeing with this statement. Even China is democratized, there should be unification. 73% of young people disagree, right? And those agree, only 24.4. If you look at the age beyond 40, actually there are more people agreeing with this one, right? Almost the same, but a little bit more, right? It's equal, but there's a substantial difference here. So this is one thing. Second, regarding the second question, Taiwan should claim independence if such claim would not result in a war. Interestingly, look at the blue bar. What do you find? Actually, there are more people among the young cohort disagree with this statement than agree. I was surprised, okay? I don't know. More interestingly is, if we cross-tab these two questions, we got this. We have four categories, four typologies. If you agree on conditional, this, so to speak, peaceful independence, but not agree on democratic unification, then you have national Taiwanese nationalism, right? The other way, if you agree on democratic unification but disagree on peaceful independence, then you have a Chinese nationalism. If you agree on both, either way, you do, then you're pragmatism. Okay? And if you disagree on both, which means you want status quo, I don't want any kind of change, that is pro-status quo. So you have four typology. And this is the general distribution of these four typology. Interestingly, the biggest category is what? Status quo. Well, it's not a surprise, given the six category measurement. And pragmatism, actually, is there not much of them. How about young people? There you go. The green bar is the age cohort below 29. Actually, among the people below 29, status quo is the biggest group. 44.3%. Taiwan nationalism, of course, is also high. 32.5. Pragmatism is very little. Chinese nationalism, of course, is even less. Less than 10%. So, naturally born pro-independence, but still the status quo is the biggest group. So, again, that testifies to my interpretation. Qianrandu actually means anti-unification among the young people, instead of advocating for de jure independence. Okay? So actually, I think Taiwanese young people are pro-status quo. Of course, because from mainland China's interpretation, anything other than agreeing with one China principle is independence. So in that way, you can say they are pro-independence. Okay? But we have to be careful about the term because it can be very slippery. So this is basically the conclusion. I don't want to say that again. So let's go to the third question. Commitment to self-defense. As many of you may be aware, there is a very popular measurement of this question conducted by Professor Emerson New from Duke University. He has been doing this, I think, around 10 years. His research was also delegated to the Center for Electoral Studies. So again, you know, we use the same institute to do this research. This is his report. He asked a question if Taiwan, this is the question in 2017 that he asked. If Taiwan and mainland China go to war, what would you do? It's an open-ended question, okay? It's open-ended question. He allowed the respondent to fill up their own answer, and then afterwards, the research assistant recode these answers into categories. So, for some people, I didn't say who, for some people, it can be methodologically controversial because there are different ways to recode these open-ended answers. Right? Run away, oh my god, 18%. Okay, and what is that going with the flow? What does that mean? I don't know. I didn't laugh, you guys laugh, okay? Here is the breakdown. Oh my god, 27% of young people want to run away. Oh, what a bad picture. Okay, so I've been wondering about this issue for a long time, okay? It's my turn. I'm asking different questions with different preconditions when I ask this question. Would you fight for Taiwan? In Chinese, Wei Taiwan or Zhan, okay? Wei Taiwan or Zhan, it's very precise. And the way they answer the question, either yes or no, okay? Would you fight for Taiwan if Taiwan formally announced independence that causes the mainland China to use force against Taiwan? Okay? Another question is, this is a question about, this is about yourself, and this is about what you think other people would do. Okay? There's a difference. Those, to my surprise actually, they're actually more than half people, more than 50%, 56% of people who said yes, they were different from Taiwan. Even the war is caused by our declaration of announcement of independence. But here, if you ask whether other people would do the same, it decreases to 43%. Right? Okay. Oh, by the way, before 2017, Emerson News study always have this precondition. He only asked this precondition, not the other precondition that I'm going to ask. Okay? So the answer of his data in the past 9 years are based on this precondition that Taiwan unilaterally announced independence and then there's war. And would you like to fight for that? Only last year, he took the precondition out. That was the result of the, that was the result that I just reported. So here is another one with another precondition. That is a more likely scenario right now. Would you fight for Taiwan if the mainland China uses force against Taiwan for unification, coercive unification? Right? That is more likely scenario right now. The previous scenario was like 10 years ago, or maybe more than that. That was during Chen Shui-bian era. Still lingering around people's memory, but this doesn't exist right now. Here is the scenario. Look at the percentage. It was amazing. Almost 70% says they are willing to fight. What a big difference from Emerson News data. Okay, of course, again, I'm not saying who is right, who is wrong. We are asking different questions. We allow people to respond differently. This is the way I ask and the way I allow people to answer yes or no. If you ask other people, they say 55, still more than half. How about young people? Right? Strawberry. If you ask the independence question, still, there are more young people who are willing to fight. More than the average. 63%. Okay? And if you ask the coercive unification question, there's not much difference. 70%. Of young people are willing to fight. Okay? So the message is clear. The strawberries are very hard. Hard to chew. I don't know which kind, but hard to chew. Here is another thing. Okay, this is statistically not significant, so I'm not going to talk about it. But this one is statistically significant. We ran a regression. That is, to what extent the democratic commitment, the support for democracy, democratic value, can strengthen people's determination to fight, to defend, right? So, under the condition of coercive unification, the commitment to democracy has a significant positive contribution to the determination to defend. Okay, we had a regressions numerical. I'm not going to talk about that. But as you can see, the percentage in this group, higher democratic support, is higher than here, right? The other group. Okay. So, the conclusion. Taiwanese youth are not irresponsibly provocative. Sorry, there's a typo here. There, okay? If previously depicted by those results that on the one hand, they're passionate about independence, but they're not committed to defense, I don't have this picture, okay? It's wrong. They have strong commitment to democratic values and self-defense. Second, Taiwanese youth are have stronger Taiwanese nationalism. But the 20 to 29 age cohort has stronger tendency to maintain status quo than other age cohort. Among the youth of 20 to 29, more of them identify with maintaining status quo than Taiwanese nationalism. So the essence of naturally born pro-independence actually is anti-unification. In facing China's military threat for coercive unification, around 70% of Taiwanese are committed to fight, and the democratic values help Taiwanese people to fight against the threat from China. So that's my preliminary report of this survey. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Shi Xian, for that very comprehensive and also very interesting set of data and interpretation of those data. Next, I'll invite Dan to provide his reactions to Shi Xian's presentation.
Thanks. It's really great to be here. Dr. Su, we met in my first week on the job last September at the Community for Democracy Summit, and I can say it now, you know, in your first week in the job, you have no idea what you're doing. So we had a very nice lunch where I pretended to be an expert in things. I think I'm now starting to get a grip, but thank you. And Russell, I'm delighted to be here. I mean, I follow the Institute's work, and it's really nice to finally make it over to see you. So thank you. So I don't have slides, so you win in terms of what people will remember. And I must say, it's very interesting because I took a lot of notes initially, and then I became more and more interested to the point where I actually forgot to finish taking my notes. But so I will just offer four or five reactions broadly. And just to broaden it out a bit, because, you know, I don't think, you know, it hasn't been said very explicitly, but obviously one of the great drivers of some of these numbers is not simply the amazing democratic success story that is Taiwan, but really the personalization of one-man rule combined with the economic developmental miracle in China, right? And the fact that China is now ruled by a leader who I think wants to demonstrate, not simply demonstrate, but almost export the Chinese model. When he says, you know, China does offer an alternative pathway for countries to economically modernize very aggressively, very successfully, but not to have all this messy political choice and accountability, right? So this is actually a fundamental shift in Chinese statecraft. I mean, Chinese leaders have not traditionally said this in the modern era. It's a significant shift. And I think we should just talk about this a little bit, the contrast about the fact that you couldn't even do this kind of public opinion research in China, one. And so I find this town, Washington, is full of people who are China experts. We know a lot of them. Many of them are very good. But so often, experts, including on TV and elsewhere, talk about China as this great unitary country, and, you know, Xi Jinping reflects the will of the people and the voice of the people and this sort of thing. And I must say, you know, I'd love to get some equivalent numbers from China if you could really poll there to find out what Chinese people really think, if they felt free to tell you what they really think. And I would particularly love to see those numbers around young people, because everywhere I go in the world, I mean, we're working in almost 100 countries, right? Everywhere I go in the world, young people have such aspirations for their future. They are so comfortable in this very technologically connected society that we live in. They understand the value of networks and kind of horizontal ties of influence and accomplishment. These old vertical structures, not just of strongmen, but of monopolistic political systems that breed corruption and backdoor dealings and all this sort of thing, this does not make sense to young people in any country I go to. I mean, in the last few months, I've been in Bangladesh, in Thailand, in Nigeria, in Bosnia, in Mexico. I mean, I can go on, but this isn't sort of just a question for Northeast Asia. The fact is that everywhere we go, young people don't see themselves as being part of any kind of vertical of power. They see what happens when strong men make deals in ways that are not transparent and accountable, right? So I was recently in South Asia. We have a program in Sri Lanka. In Sri Lanka, the previous government under Rajapaksa ceded significant chunks of the country's sovereignty to China in return for lots of money for him and his family. Lots of development projects that included, you know, a special package for the leader. And there was actually a nationalistic reaction to this in Sri Lanka. We've seen it in Burma, which I'm sorry to say is not a happy story today, just given the Rohingya crisis. But in fact, we saw this in Burma, that you had an autocratic structure under the junta that allowed a huge Chinese footprint, mainland Chinese footprint in that country. And there was really a visceral nationalistic reaction to that, which led to the political opening. So this is not to get off topic, but it's to say that I think young people really do have a different sense of things. One, but two, irrespective of demographic age group, nationalism and self-determination remain as powerful motivating forces for human societies today as I think they did 100 years ago when Woodrow Wilson, this is the 100th anniversary, 101st anniversary of his 14-point speech. But these are not old-fashioned concepts, right? I mean, you have a column in the New York Times today by David Brooks saying that the great debate of our time, the great debate of our age, is between autocracy and democracy, right? There are alternative models, not just in mainland China, but in Russia, now in Turkey under Erdogan, elsewhere. We have seen a shrinking of democratic space in those and other countries. But in fact, I don't think that is not the definitive trend of our time. I think the definitive trend of our time will be the reaction to that shrinking space and that personalization of rule, including from young people. And this gets to the point, coming back to kind of Taiwan and China and how each of them sees their future, the relationship between them. China's economic miracle, in one sense, is unprecedented simply given its scale, right? 1.3 billion people have never actually done this on this scale. Okay. But it's not unprecedented in terms of the pace. I mean, we saw it happen in Japan after 1945. We saw it happen in Taiwan. We saw it happen in Singapore. We've seen it happen in South Korea. So what is different about China's economic modernization is the scale. It's not actually the pace. And I think so many people, including in Washington, have become so mesmerized by China's economic accomplishments that they have taken their eye off of the fact that, of course, dictatorship in China, in mainland China in a previous period, 1949 to the death of Mao, destroyed probably more economic value than has ever been destroyed in outside of war anyway, right? And that most dictatorships end up looking like Venezuela today, or Congo, or other kind of economically abysmal places that really have fallen apart and that do not meet their people's basic needs. And so when we think about these questions around democracy and the future of the Taiwan-China relationship, you know, I think the claim that we would make, Dr. Su and I at least, given our institutional roles, is not that democracy solves all problems and produces heaven on earth. It doesn't do that. I mean, look at America today. It doesn't do that. But what it does do is institutionalize ways to cooperate. It channels conflict to peaceful ends, right, so that you don't end up with civil wars or jihadist violence or others. It includes people. It's inclusive, so you don't have angry young men with nothing to do, as there are today in places like Egypt, who want to then take their revolt out of the system and into insurgency or terrorism. It also reduces political risk. You know, I think as a modest investor, I'm perfectly comfortable having money in a country like Taiwan's stock market. I must say, the political risk associated with one-man rule in a country like China or Russia just is actually extreme. And so when strongmen offer these reassuring platitudes that, no, you know, we don't have all these messy elections and political divisiveness and factions in our politics, you know, the party is unified under one man. There is just extraordinary risk investing that much power and influence in one man or one woman, right? And it creates a huge amount of economic risk. It really creates the kind of context for the misallocation of investments, for the use of economic resources towards the ends of the state rather than towards private ends, right? It diminishes entrepreneurship and all of the good grassroots energy that comes from a true private sector, because you can't have a true private sector in a country controlled by one party with kind of penetrative control. lack of freedom of information, lack of association, etc. So, you know, I think if we are going to accept this argument that there is a contest of systems underway, I mean, if we're going to take up Xi Jinping's proposition, I think many of us are quite comfortable to say, okay, right? Bring it on. I mean, even though American democracy is not looking perfect today, even though Europe is very divided, right? Even though populism is on the march, even though democracy looks like it's under-delivering in many places, I still think we can make a compelling case that at the end of the day, this is a better system for young people to rise up into the world in. And everywhere I go, that is actually how young people see things. And they don't necessarily see things in an ideological way. They simply think about their own aspirations, their own educational aspirations, their professional aspirations, their social aspirations. And they don't understand how those aspirations can be fulfilled in the absence of political space and contestation, right? So they may not all be expressly political, but I think they have a very modern vision of what they want their country to be and what they want the world to be. And the generational divides that we saw in the polling are a real reflection, not just of different historical eras, but there is a sort of sentimental yearning in some countries for the strong hand, right? And that sentimental yearning often does come from people who may not be entirely comfortable using the internet, or who may not be on social media, who may not use all of the digital tools that most of us take for granted. And so it's a throwback to a previous age, but I think when we look ahead, those trends are just not sustainable, which is why I'm still an optimist. I'm still an optimist, not just about Taiwan, not just about America, but about Asia and the world writ large. And I'd love to discuss these things, because of course this is a hard case to make these days, sitting in Washington, D.C. But thank you for this amazing work and the chance just to talk about it here today.
Thank you very much, Dan. Before I open it up with my questions, I wanted to give Sijian an opportunity also to respond to some of Dan's comments. And one that particularly struck me was when he mentioned about sort of the appeal of the success of the PRC's economy and the scale of that economy. And I wonder to what extent does that have any impact, perhaps, on youth attitudes towards China? Because I think that's actually an interesting question. And any other additional responses that you may have?
Hmm. Yeah, you guys touch upon a topic that I'm going to make a presentation next time. I do have questions with that regarding this same survey, some of the questions, but not many. But to be able to answer that question, so to speak, scientifically, I need to do some analysis. But let me give you my rough impression. Is that, as I already presented in the data today, I think the people, young people under the age of 29 in Taiwan, they do have very strong Taiwanese identity. That is for sure. But in terms of a very concrete political and economic relation with mainland China, I think they are very pragmatic. You know, pragmatic in the way that they think status quo serves their interests best, first of all. Second, I, at least from my, you know, contact with my students or the young people in Taiwan, they don't stop themselves from tapping into the, so to speak, economic opportunities presented by mainland China's markets. But I also know a lot of people going to mainland China to work. The fact that they work over there does not necessarily imply there will be impact on their identity. They go there to work for the need to raise their family. But more often than not, they don't quite like the way of life there. They enjoy the convenience. For example, you buy everything from your mobile phone. But at the same time, they are also aware by doing that you are sacrificing your privacy to the state, to the communist state. And you know the consequences. And they are bothered by the often interrupted communication with their family back in Taiwan. You know, whenever they uttered certain unspoken words, you know, there were immediate interruption. That happened to me once. I had a conversation with my friends in China. And he talked about 19th Party Congress, and all of a sudden it stopped. The conversation stopped. China is efficient in terms of that. So yes, you know, on the economic side, China's market is still very important in a realistic way. But there's two sides of the coin. So on the other side, I think the trend of people's identification is also very clear.
Great, and perhaps if I could stick with you, Sujin, is that, and this relates to the PRC's economy, and the Beijing government recently, in late February, passed 31 measures that include a raft of incentives as well as preferential treatments for Taiwanese persons as well as businesses to do business, to work, to live, you know, find jobs in China. What do you think are Beijing's intentions in passing these measures, and what impacts do you think these measures may have on Taiwan's youth attitudes?
The intention is more than obvious. It's part of their coercive strategy, overall strategy, to coerce Taiwan into their scheme of, or their path of unification. What the people call the soft strategy will get softer and the hard get harder. And on the hard part, you know, there are bombers and aircraft carriers circulating around Taiwan for how many times a year? I don't know. I lost the count. 7 or 8. It costs them a lot of money. It costs us a lot of money, too, to monitor them. But the they are doing this not only to Taiwan. There are 40, you know, fleets in South China Sea recently. Are these measures, 31 measures, effective? Well, we don't know. Let's see. Some of them are old measures. They just, you know, wrap it into the 31 thing. But some of them are new. Some of them are aiming at draining the brand from our young generation and also our professional groups and to the job market to mainland China. Some of them, you know, may provide a substantial incentive for certain people. We can't deny the fact. But on the other hand, the good news is it also prompts a Taiwanese government to do something. Wow, that's good. Well, let's see, it's a competition, you know. And again, as I said, you know, even you drive people from Taiwan to work in China, it provides them material interests. But there's, as I said, there's another side of the coin. May not necessarily change their identity. Because, you know, we're talking about human beings. Human beings are not animals. You know, we don't have just material needs. We have emotions, identity, and values. Guess what? We have values. That's important. So I really disagree that certain people, particularly certain friends from China, that look down upon our democratic procedures and say, wow, that's just procedures. No, it's not just procedures. It's values. It's very important. And as I've already shown to you that our young people are serious about this issue. So I hope the Chinese government can be also serious about our young people.
I think it's interesting, Sujin. I mean, I think another sort of data point that supports, I think, your interpretation is that over time, if you think about how just economic relations between Taiwan and China have boomed in the last 20 years, and yet, you know, support for democracy in Taiwan has actually been never been stronger, right? And so actually, in fact, you know, there is greater support for Taiwan, within Taiwan, for democracy, while there's this, you know, really intensifying economic relationship. So it doesn't seem like there is a sort of a causal relationship between, a stronger economic ties with China and weakening support for democracy in Taiwan. But I'd like to stick with you also as well, because there's another point that you made in highlighting how an overwhelming majority of people in Taiwan still identify themselves as being Taiwanese, as opposed to Chinese, and this is like 55.3% to 3.7% in 2017. And this is according to the National Chinese University's Election Study Center, I believe the same center that you utilize to conduct your polling. But this is actually a gradual decrease from 60.6% in 2014 of people who identify themselves as Taiwanese. I found this quite interesting. I don't know what the cause of that is, but what do you think accounts for this downward trend?
Yeah, the way that the that question is asked is usually for people to choose between three alternatives. One is Taiwanese, or another is Chinese, another is both, right? So that's one kind of measurement. So when you Russell, you mentioned the decrease from 66% in 60.6% in 2014
to
55.3%. Right. And then where does that 5% go? That's the question. I guess maybe to the double identity, right? At least not to the Chinese identity. I think that's the interpretation. So my interpretation, my take of that is, actually it does not necessarily mean the rise of Chinese nationalism. Or should I say, not the rise of Chinese nationalism, but let's say a double identification, you know. Or if you reflect that into Unite's measurement, I would guess those 5% go to the status quo category. Okay, so again, as shown in my data, I think the youngest cohort of young people in Taiwan, they're actually very, very strong pro-status quo. They like the status quo. They are willing to defend the status quo. So therefore, I won't read too much into that 5% change. That's my take.
And Dan, I'm going to turn to you right now. And if you could, I know you never really taken off your foreign policy hat, and you had a very distinguished career in foreign policy, both in government and in think tanks. And so your opinions on these matters are greatly valued here, especially in the context of our discussion now. And I wish you could maybe perhaps turn your focus now on really sort of looking at these trends that that Dr. Xu has highlighted in terms of his presentation of this, you know, sort of greater support for democracy in Taiwan, you know, a preference for the status quo among even younger generations. This is the 20 to 29 cohorts, but you know, really the future leaders really of Taiwan, and willingness to defend and fight for Taiwan. Now, what do you think this means, you know, or what implications will this have for the future of cross-strait relations, and what are the potential implications for U.S. policy?
So it's easy, 30,000-foot question, and I'd like to explain it this way. You know, there's a lot of loose talk about the individual world order, that America sustained this global system for 70-plus years, and now we're done doing that, right? The
natural successor to a liberal world underwritten by American and allied leadership is kind of a spheres of influence world of raw balance of power politics and heightened military competition, a heightened focus on hard power, right, over rules and institutions. I don't believe that, but that is sort of what would follow a true American retreat and retrenchment. Now, I do know from visiting Taiwan and many other places that nobody actually wants to live in another country's sphere of influence, right? So we have this theological conversation about a new age of empire, you know, a Chinese system that controls much of Asia, maybe a new Russian Empire that cuts into Central Asia and part of Europe, a kind of a North American, I don't know, almost fortress, right? The problem with that vision is that nobody outside of those countries wants it, right? Ukrainians don't want to be ruled from Moscow. Taiwanese don't want to be ruled from Beijing. Indonesians don't want to be governed by Chinese, Vietnamese, etc. The same. The United States itself, I think, would be much more impoverished. I actually think we would be okay in this world because of our natural resource endowments, our strategic geography with the ocean buffers, etc., etc. But we would be impoverished for it because our leadership in the world has made us a better country. And the fact that we do have, say, an alliance system in Asia has drawn us out to the defense of liberal values and liberal institutions. And the fact that we have worked with our friends around the world to create a set of international institutions has been good for the United States, right? Sharing power in that sense, giving friends and allies and other countries, including China, a voice in these councils, has actually been good for the United States and has created an order that has produced more human prosperity and more human welfare than any other order in human history. So that is an answer to your question. That's part of it because, you know, I think this, again, going back to kind of what Xi Jinping has been saying recently about reunification, and I think he certainly sees a historic objective of rallying the Chinese nation, not just around his leadership, but around kind of an assertion of Chinese power in its near abroad. It's not viable because it doesn't to account the consent of the other side. And I think it would be very bad for China, right? I don't actually think Chinese people want to live in a new empire with a new emperor. I think Chinese people actually want a lot of the things that Taiwanese people want and American people want and Venezuelan people want, which is just, I mean, I observed elections in Pakistan in 2013, and Pakistan, you know, it's, you think it's very scary and it's full of jihadists and, you know, there's a very dangerous rogue wing of the intelligence service that supports terrorism and all of this stuff. And so I spent a lot of time out of the capital, out in the real Pakistan, talking to Pakistani voters standing in long lines to vote. And I would ask all of them, what do you want, right? And none of them said, I want to wage jihad, right? Or I want to support. And they all wanted an education for their children, some job opportunities to improve their lot, right? A government that was not corrupt, that did not steal. This is what people want all over the world. So I'm actually pretty confident that history is not on the side of those who would build new empires or who would concentrate power at the expense of any public choice or voice. I was very interested in the polling question around, if China were a democracy, would reunification be acceptable to you? And actually, opinion was not as clear-cut as one might expect. And it goes back to your point about identity and nationalism actually being continuing drivers. In this globalized world in which we live, I think the identity with the nation actually has become more powerful. We've seen that in good ways in places like Taiwan. We've seen that in bad ways in parts of Europe that where it has kind of resurged old ethnic hatreds, right, in the Balkans, around anti-Semitism and else other things. So there are these, it does feel like there is a real tug of war in the world today between kind of this very modern pluralistic future that I think most people actually want and these forces of reaction, right, that are opposed to that. And the Taiwan-China dyad is just very interesting because each side essentially represents one of those polar opposite forces. But I'm still optimistic, and, you know, this point about sort of Taiwanese having a preference for the status quo has incubated a very strong and rich democracy in Taiwan. And, you know, I think we as Americans underappreciate that, not just in Taiwan, but in South Korea and really around the world, the role that U.S. alliances and partnerships have played in incubating inclusive modern systems, which isn't to give us the credit, because the credit belongs to the people of those countries, right? But we tend to, I don't like this astute, this very modern emphasis on hard power and grand strategy, because it undervalues the kind of societies that our geopolitics have actually nurtured for 70 years.
Thank you so much, Dan. Perhaps I'd like to stick with you for one moment. You mentioned something that was really, really important, and you wrote an excellent op-ed about this with Richard Fontaine, about the need for democracies to work closer together. And I wonder to what extent do you think that is there's an opportunity now, for that, because this is not an idea that sort of just recently started. I mean, it's been around, for quite some time. What sort of motivated you, perhaps, if I could just ask you briefly, to write that piece, and whether or not what is the context now that you see as the need for and perhaps an opportunity to strengthen ties among democratic countries?
Thank you for asking that. So I'll be brief, because I'm sorry, I don't mean to be long-winded, but we really care about these issues quite passionately. So there is a new strategic edge to the democracy work that we are doing these days. You know, I think since 1989, we ran out of competition. We thought we had won, and then we didn't cede the field, but we moved on to other things. And in Russia, in China, in Iran, I mean, there is competition from systems that are going out and subverting and undermining open societies. And so, I mean, Richard and I are continuing some work on some longer pieces because, there used to be an agenda of let's go out and kind of enlarge the world, if you will. But now it looks like quite a different agenda, and that was kind of on the basis of it's a good thing to do, and democracies make better partners, better allies, better markets, right? Now I think the argument is actually somewhat different. I think all of those things are still true. But authoritarian competitors are on the march, and they're using tools of influence below the threshold of military power to undermine and subvert open societies. And unless you live through the Cold War, which most of us didn't in this room, or we're not of age, I think a lot of us have grown out of practice in thinking about the fact that hostile powers actually want to undermine our systems. And that's different from wanting to divide our alliances. I mean, that's different from sort of who controls the South China Sea. That's not really, it's not an over there question, it's a right here at home question, right? You saw it in the 2016 election with Russian meddling. The Russians now, by the way, are working to subvert elections in Mexico and Colombia, all over Europe. I mean, I'm afraid it's not just about us. Americans like to think it's always about us. It's really not just about us. China is using a different toolkit, but through the Belt and Road, through some of the investment projects, through some of the projections of SOE and other forms of influence, I think is doing something not entirely dissimilar through United Front tactics, and countries like Australia and New Zealand is insinuating the influence of state power into open democratic systems, and then using that influence to erode American alliances, to create doubts around the wisdom of this or that China policy in those countries. So I think we just have to be quite alert, have our eyes wide open on issues, because democracies are uniquely vulnerable. And I think we have grown out of, and Taiwan hasn't, because it knows how vulnerable it is, but most of us have forgotten how vulnerable democracy is, and have forgotten about the need to defend it, because we frankly have not had real competitors.
Thank you so much. And so now we have around a little over 15 minutes for audience Q&A. So if you can please state your name as well as your affiliation, and direct your question to one of the or both panelists. And if you could keep it as a question, that'd be great. Thank you. This gentleman in the back.
Hello. Hi there. Yeah, my name is Kobe Furlan. I'm at the East West Center down the street here. Thank you both for being here. Really appreciate your insights. One question I had, going back to youth public opinion specifically, and it could be for either of you, I mean, your experience observing elections or your survey data over the years. I'm curious just what impact does U.S. policy or administration changes here have on youth public opinion in Taiwan, if any? I mean, so for example, you had some really provocative questions in your in the survey that you put out. What if you had something there like, Would you support Taiwan independence if the U.S. were to reestablish diplomatic relations? I mean, does that kind of thing have a major impact? I mean, it's so unclear, I know, with the administration and the turnover rate. It was unclear when I lived in Taiwan. Now in the middle of D.C., it's unclear here still. But I'd be really curious about what impact we actually have on youth public opinion abroad. Thanks.
Question, then we'll give some time for the other.
Okay, since there are no hands up, I have two. Well, this is a big hypothetical question. Best I can have is a big hypothetical answer. I don't have concrete numbers, but the general feeling in Taiwan is that the Taiwanese government as well as the society really appreciate and we're thankful for the support provided by U.S. Congress and U.S. administration, and as well as U.S. people. To support Taiwan's democracy in a time when they're bullied and the threats from outside. This is very, very important. For a long time, Taiwan has been diplomatically isolated, so there's among some people, there's this feeling that we're being neglected. Our democracy has not been appreciated. But in recent years, it's changing atmosphere. To some extent, I have to say, thanks to China's success, there's changing of mood that the our effort has been seen and appreciated by the world, and including the support from U.S. So that's definitely very positive. We know that we have good friends, not only in the Congress, but increasing number in the Trump administration. Generally speaking, of course that's positive. But your big hypothetical question, the resumption of diplomatic relation, I mean, I dreamed about it, but it remains in my dream. As I said, Taiwanese people, particularly young people, are in general pragmatic. And we know that we are at best a middle power, and there are right now, let's say, disagreement among the major powers in our region. And usually, under such a circumstance, we tend to be cautious, but at the same time, we also think it's a good opportunity to strengthen the relationship between Taiwan and other like-minded countries, not only U.S., and we have made some progress on this. So I think our government and our people will try our best to grasp this opportunity.
Garrett?
Hi, Garrett Van Der Weis. I'm now teaching of Taiwan at George Mason University. Thanks for an excellent presentation. I had a point on your conclusion that the majority of the students would be for the status quo. I think it helps if you emphasize that there are three different versions of the status quo. I think China, of course, says the status quo is that we are recognized internationally and Taiwan is down there, not important. The U.S. status quo is quite different. It says, well, yes, we recognize PRC as the government of China. We have unofficial relations with Taiwan. But for the people in Taiwan in general, the status quo is we are now a free and democratic country. And as Dan emphasized in his statement just now, that is the status quo that is really the same as being a free and democratic country. So that supports your eventual conclusion that it's not the same as unification, of course, but I think that helps in the analysis. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much. I can agree more with what you said. Yes, I think when I further made that this into an article, I'll definitely add that too. And it is true that the when I say status quo, I would put in this into the context that Taiwanese people, particularly the young people, are not provocative in terms of being very rushed into de jure independence. That's not the case. So, but of course, there, as I said, the interpretation of naturally born pro-independence is actually anti-unification, particularly anti the formula proposed by Beijing. That's very obvious. Thank you very much.
I thought an additional point that you made in your presentation, which was also quite interesting, it's that when you said that what you implied was anti-unification does not necessarily also mean pro-independence. Did I get that right, or did I?
Well, that's because this is so confusing. It depends on how do you define these verbs, these words. In Beijing's definition, anything that this is does not adhere to their One China principle, or so to speak, 92 consensus, is independence, pro-independence, right? So their definition of independence is very wide scope. Everything other than their formula is independence. And they have a lot of adjectives to these, cultural independence, blah, 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 independence, and everything that they can imagine. But whereas in Taiwan's definition, usually when we say independence, it can mean also many things, but relatively speaking, more toward de jure independence. So, of course, if you break that down, it can have further, gray areas of between categories. So the same thing with status quo. Depends how we define it.
Right. In the sense that, anti-unification doesn't necessarily mean pro-de jure independence.
Right.
And in fact, it means more of pro-status quo, right?
Pro-status quo, yeah, meaning that they think the current relationship with China that we have, we see ourselves as independent sovereign country, of which the title is ROC, and usually we call ourselves Taiwan, and we would like to be called Taiwan. That is the status quo, okay, according to my definition.
Okay.
Instead of common / something else.
Right. Do we have any questions? Nadia?
Hi, Nadia Chao, Washington correspondent for Liberty Times. I have a question for Shijie.
Yes.
Based on your poll, what's the implication for Taiwan's major party or political leader in accordance to the mainland China policy? Right now it seems like DPP and Chinese are having a deadlock on the agreement of a One China principle or a One China policy. But do you think the young voter will throw DPP out of the bus because, the deadlock? Or actually, this is what the most young voter would like to see, to defend their status quo? If you were in their shoes, what's the cross-strait policy that will actually meet the young generation's demand? Thank you.
Well, the thing is, when it comes to Taiwan's domestic politics, it's always complicated, multiple factor issue. Anyone that is thrown out of the bus could be a result of many other reasons, not necessarily cross-strait relations. It could be dissatisfaction of resuming the second nuclear power plant, or something else. So, but on the cross-strait relations, of course, I didn't ask that question, but I don't think if you let me guess, I don't think young people are so dissatisfied with the cross-strait policy of Thai government. Of course, as I said, there are always concerned citizens with dissatisfaction. But dissatisfaction coming from different directions. There are more progressive, I have a lot of progressive civil society friends in Taiwan. They are so critical of Thai administration. And there are deep green people criticizing Thai administration of not being making more progress, particularly in amending the referendum law. But there are also criticism from the Pan Blue side on transitional justice issue. So you have dissatisfaction from all sides. But in general, broad picture of the cross-strait relations, there may be criticism on Tsai administration of not making, let's say, not necessarily on the 92 consensus issue, but on managing a better economic connection with China. I think there could be opinions like that, but not necessarily like we should make some further move on the political front with China. I don't think that's the opinion. So again, everyone has this big hypothetical question, so my answer is always big hypothetical too. If you put myself into the current administration's shoes, I probably would do almost the same. You know, what we can score right now is, particularly given Xi Jinping's, so to speak, ambition. So his ambition is not only toward Taiwan. He has a global ambition, rejuvenizing Chinese nation on a global level. You know, when he mentioned about what's that, the community of common destiny of humankind. I mean, what does that mean? It's not only against Taiwan. I mean, it means something big. So cross-strait relations is part of that picture. Then we have to think in that context. Given that context, I don't think we need to make much change right now, because things are evolving at much larger scale. You know, and cross-strait relations is part of that. So I would say more important things is to score with developing more substantial relationship with our partners, like-minded countries, as I said. These are the things that need further efforts.
Any more questions? Oh, okay.
I'm Janice Chen with the DPP office here in D.C. Thank you very much, Dr. Xu, for this presentation, and especially for TFD for doing the survey. I would say that the third part of the survey on the commitment to defend Taiwan's democracy is especially timely, and it's something where, you know, in our work with the U.S. and in U.S.-Taiwan relations, there's a real demand for more of this data and an understanding about attitudes, about young Taiwanese attitudes toward defending Taiwan. And I guess, so your conclusion is that it's actually, this commitment is a lot higher than is usually perceived. But I guess the context in which this question usually comes up is when we're looking at defense planning, and especially now where Taiwan is trying to transition to a volunteer force, and the military is having difficulty sort of hitting their recruitment targets. So I guess, how do you interpret that? What would be the policy interpretation immediately from these results? Do you think that there's some gap between the abstract concept of defending Taiwan's democracy and the military as it's currently constituted? Is it that it's, you know, the linkage between the military and defending Taiwan's democracy is not as clearly articulated? How do you usually, how would you kind of interpret that in this discussion in defense planning?
Yeah, thank you for this question. There's this question I didn't ask in my survey that maybe I'll ask next time. So I'll reserve the third presentation here. That is, I like to ask our young people whether they agree or not to resume the conscription system. You know, this is politically very controversial. Again, I'm just curious from an academic or a perspective of a concerned citizen about this issue. I don't know the answer. You guys can guess. Don't make me guess again. I think if we ask that question right now, the support from young people particularly for those who have not served in the military, I think the support will not be very high, but I don't know. The background can be complicated because young people usually do not have very good impression on what military is like and what military service can be. The Guojun, our military usually is very slow in building up their new image, and when they do, usually there's some problem in their propaganda. So I think there are a lot that they can improve that. But at the same time, we have increasing bullying, military bullying from the PLA around Taiwan, and that's also connected to the stability in the region. So it is a daunting challenge, I think. And I'm, on my part, I'm willing to do more to educate our public, and including young people in Taiwan, about the seriousness of this issue. And for those people who are willing to defend democracy, I think we also have this obligation to strengthen our military power, to show, to validate our determination, you know, with substantial commitment in terms of money, I mean, the tax that we pay, making better use of that, at least to show to the international community that we are serious about our commitment. I think that's also very important.
Sure. Well, last question.
I have a question for Dr. Twining. In your, observations earlier about, you know, the importance of democracy in our time and versus autocracy, I wanted to ask you what your opinion is, and what in different countries that you visited, what their views are in terms of China's One Belt, One Road initiative, because that seems to be a very aggressive way to, you know, campaign around the world and to sort of building everybody's infrastructure and allowing them to feel like they're doing something, and, you know, in the name of you know, building that specific countries. So, and I've heard, you know, people from like Ethiopian cab drivers sort of, you know, telling me, praising the virtues of, you know, Chinese, you know, benevolent sort of ways, if you will. So I wonder what your views are, and what the other countries that you visited, what their views are in terms of what their attitudes is. Do they view this as, you know, sort of a great way, and it's just also a threat to embracing democracy in some of these countries?
Thank you. It's not actually a softball question, because it's quite complex. In my last think tank job, I actually went around in Asia talking to countries about this question. And of course, the answer is evolving, because the Belt and Road as a concept is quite exciting, right? I mean, the way it's framed in speeches says, you know, the new Marshall Plan, and we will unify Eurasia. It's very grand. And the other thing is, you go to a lot of countries and they need a lot of infrastructure. I mean, I used to live in India. It desperately needs infrastructure. I used to live in Africa. It desperately needs it. So we can't, as Americans, we can't go to these countries and say, don't accept other countries' infrastructure, because we're not offering, right? But, you know, I think the view is evolving in some of these countries. Even in Pakistan, which in some ways is the center of the Belt and Road. I mean, China's infrastructure splash there preceded the Belt and Road, but it's kind of the centerpiece in many regards. There is a conversation about the new East India Company, about how China will strengthen the wrong elements in Pakistani military circles at the expense of civilian control. In Pakistan, there is a set of concerns, which I think are replicated in other countries, about the viability of many projects, right? Are you really going to develop a road and rail and pipeline infrastructure through Balochistan and protect it? And how are you going to protect it with Chinese troops? How are you going to protect this infrastructure in no man's land, which is in the midst of a low-grade civil war and has been since Pakistan became independent in 1947? In Sri Lanka, I mean, sorry, I don't mean to revert to anecdotes, but in Sri Lanka, about a year ago, I was trying to get to a hotel to meet a Sri Lankan for lunch, and the hotel was on the sea, and in between my car in the hotel were 20,000 protesters. And I said, gosh, you know, what are they protesting? Oh, they're protesting Chinese influence in Sri Lanka, you know, because the Hambantota port, we've ceded our sovereignty to China because of these Belt and Road schemes and the corruption that accompanied them. And I said, oh, that's interesting. People are protesting. Who's leading the protest? And the answer was Mahinda Rajapaksa. Mahinda Rajapaksa was the dictatorial leader in Sri Lanka who actually did these initial deals with China to cede control of strategic infrastructure to the Chinese. But now he's in opposition and he has realized that this nationalist card against China is a useful one for him to play. Because the current government in Sri Lanka, which is much more responsible, found itself no recourse but to basically continue this cooperation with China. So that's one part of the picture. Another part of the picture is in Europe, is in countries like Greece and Serbia and Hungary, where actually it looks quite different, Bulgaria, where there is a naivete about the nature of the Chinese system and the fact that this is really not a private sector driven initiative. This is not market principles at work, that this is a state project to export excess capacity, build out China in very Chinese ways, with Chinese labor, with Chinese loans, not grants, with Chinese finance in these countries. And I'm quite struck, I mean, given the connectivity with the old Silk Road, I guess people over the last 500 years have forgot, that, you know, trade is associated with politics, security, and it's not just trade with the current Chinese system. And so we find when we go to Europe, you know, the Chinese own and are operating the port of Piraeus and want to build into a huge infrastructure hub to connect up into Europe. There is just a naivete, which, you know, the European Union has discovered, for instance, in discussions about statements in EU on the South China Sea or on human rights issues, is suddenly Greece is wielding a veto because it wants to protect its Chinese infrastructure investments. And you're seeing this in different ways in other European countries. So I could go on and on, but I really appreciate your question. I think we all need to keep an eye on this because it is evolving. And I think increasingly, citizens and civic actors and government officials in these countries will pull back the curtain and realize that the Chinese support comes with an extensive list of conditionalities. And yes, they're not human rights and transparency conditionalities, so many governments like those. They're not our kind of condition, but they're very Chinese conditionalities. And that involve the cession of sovereignty. I mean, we had the former foreign minister from the Maldives over at IRI 2 weeks ago. The current autocratic government of Maldives has actually sold several islands to China. And Maldives doesn't have a lot of land. I mean, you could fit it into Washington, D.C., right? So I actually think there is and will continue to be a backlash. And China, finally, I will say, in places that the Belt and Road does run through, you know, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, other tough operating environments, these are tough operating environments, and they are going to get drawn into the politics, just like they've gotten drawn into Pakistani politics. America hasn't always navigated this very well historically, and China's going to bump into the same problem, which is being a political actor in these countries and all the hazards associated with that.
Great. Well, with that excellent conclusion, please join me in thanking our panelists. Okay. Nice.